Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. Lots to talk about today. We'll discuss the England-Sri Lanka White Ball Series, the first ODI between the England and India women's sides, the latest action from the Blast. We'll look ahead to the crucial round of the County Championship that starts on Sunday, and the 100 wildcard draft. I'm Yaz Rana, and this morning I'm joined by former England batsman Mark Butcher, Wisden.com features editor Tahar Hashim, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. Thankfully, no pre-show ad reads today. We're recording this week's show from the wonderful Sixes Cricket Club in Central London. It's basically a very cool bar / restaurant with interactive cricket nets. We tried it out last week. It was quite good fun.
Yeah. Some better than others.
Yeah, I was definitely by some distance the worst. But it's very, very good.
There's a lovely impressionistic portrait of Sachin Tendulkar pointing his MRF bat at me over Mark Butcher's shoulder. By one of the nets.
Quite surreal.
It is mildly surreal. It's impressive, though.
Well, since we last recorded, England have wrapped up the T20I series against Sri Lanka 3-0, and they're 1-0 up in the ODI series. To say that the wheels have fallen off for Sri Lanka, I think, would be a bit of an understatement. Kusal Mendis, Nirushan Dikweller, and Danushka Gunathilaka were suspended pending an inquiry and sent home after the trio broke biosecure protocols before the start of the ODI series. But it's just not been vintage cricket, has it? With the exception of the first half of the run chase in the second T20I and maybe 10 minutes yesterday, there's not really been a moment where you'd say it's even been even.
No, it hasn't. And Sri Lanka are sort of veering from one catastrophe to the next. I was fortunate enough during the lockdown post-Christmas, just in the new year, to be there for the two test matches that England played back in January. And, you know, Joe Root played magnificently well, but Sri Lanka was so comfortably outplayed in their own conditions, in Gaul of all places, as to sort of you're worrying about their welfare as a cricketing nation. And, of course, on the road, that's only going to be exacerbated. They've also got problems as well in terms of discipline and player behaviour, which normally only comes when the wheels are off anyway. You can look at the individuals and kind of blame them for their behaviour, being out late at night, breaking curfew, breaking bubble protocols and all the rest of it. But that sort of stuff is always more likely when the team you're playing for is either poorly led, poorly paid, all of the other poorlies that you could possibly come up with for Sri Lanka at the moment. So, I mean, you know, 2 1-day internationals left. And barring a piece of individual brilliance, which we know Sri Lanka are capable of, Kusal Pereira just brings to mind. You cannot see how they're going to beat England in either of them. You really can't, unless England just decide not to turn up themselves for one of them. Because it's sad to see. It's sad to see how sort of the mighty have fallen in terms of Sri Lanka in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, Phil, before we get onto England, not that long ago, Sri Lanka would have come to England on a white ball tour and been overwhelming favourites, 6-7 years ago even. Do you think this is just a cyclical thing? Just this current crop of players just not quite at that level? Or do you see the shoots of the side that could progress in there? I mean, Hasaranga had a very good T20I series, and I kind of think with the batsmen, you can see there's talent there, but like none of them have just like quite kicked on, particularly in white ball cricket, to the level you kind of need.
Truth be told, I don't feel fully qualified to answer that question regarding the infrastructural issues. I mean, I know the headline stuff, as we all do. We can all obviously identify the loss of a handful of legends, but we can also identify one of those legends in Jayasuriya being banned for 2 years for admitting corruption, and that sense of there being a corrupt core in the coaching structure at that time, with Zoysa, the bowling coach, also going down as well. So something is rotten in the state there, and there's no question of that. Now, I'm not saying for a second that the current setup bears any of those hallmarks, but it does filter down that sense of what was once this kind of collective that was overachieving and producing vibrant cricket over and above its means and its resources. You're not getting that sense at the moment. And as Mark says, you know, these three lads who went out on the razzle in Durham, it's probably indicative of a sort of team culture that is not especially unified at the minute, and that, you know, that does happen. There's more chance that these boys are going to behave like that if they're feeling like they're not really it's not a cohesive whole. So there are still some young talents coming through. You know, Nisanka made that brilliant 100 on debut. He's the lad who averages something like 67 in first class cricket. And so you will still get these talents coming through. But will you get these real legacy talents, these kind of unusual cricketers, these iconic cricketers from a small island without much money and without much backing? I don't know. You feel like that what happened with the West Indies when they overachieved for decades versus their means, possibly there's a similar kind of pattern now emerging with Sri Lankan cricket. But as I say, I don't know for sure. You know, we should get Fidel Fernando on the show. Get Andrew on, you know, he'll tell us what for.
Yeah,
it's a very sad story though.
Yeah, specifically with white ball cricket, you kind of look at all the like top eight teams in the world. All of them pretty much have like two or three guys in the top six who average like 45 in ODI cricket. You know, in the same way that we've been saying that the standard of test match bowling is very high at the moment, I think the standard of white ball batting is very high. And Sri Lanka just don't quite have... Pereira kind of threatened to play one of those innings yesterday, but you just kind of feel they don't have... If they're two or three bats in away from being actually on the right side, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it was an innings where it was like, everything's going against me right now. I'm just going to go for it. I mean, I know Pereira is an attacking player to begin with, but it was that was the sense you got. And it was everything was kind of riding on him. And
captain,
once,
keeper, opening batsman, only informed player, only bloke who's even turned up on time.
Yeah.
I think only boat with an international 100 in the team as well.
Oh god, yeah. So
it did have a sense of carrying your bat, didn't it?
Yeah.
At one point yesterday, I think there's been 9 players in ODIs who have carried their bat, including the gaffer.
Yeah.
I gathered. Yes, I forgot about that. Yeah. West Indies 2000.
And when he was out for what 70 something on, it was kind of like, all right, there we go. now we move.
Before we get to England, just a word on a couple of the other Sri Lankan bowlers. Like, I think we've, you know, maybe being a bit harsh on Sri Lanka, they are missing. Not just the banned trio, but they're missing a few other batsmen out injured. But the bowling attacks actually looked quite threatening and has threatened England at various points already this series.
Yeah. A couple of beanpole quicks with real pace. You know, Kamira in particular was hitting 89s, 88s, 89s quite regularly yesterday. And so, as I say, you will still get these talents. You will still get these talents come through. The left-arm spinner as well, and the test match bowler, Embledinia, he's class as well. You feel like he's the kind of cricketer that can do it elsewhere as well as just in Sri Lanka. So, look, there will still be players. There will still be players to watch. But there's a hell of a long way to go before they can really find themselves back on that top table again, where they have been, let's be fair, for a long, long time.
Absolutely. From an England's perspective, not long to go until the T20 World Cup. Did England learn anything from that series?
I don't think so. Not really, because the thing is, you see guys come back like... Wokes and Willie, but who haven't played T20 eyes for a long time. But I mean, like, we know what they can do. Chris Wokes playing after 6 years and, you know, bowling really well. That's not really a surprise. I think the one box that maybe you could say they ticked was with Livingston in that second T20I, where it was almost like a nice, you know, practice situation where you've lost a few wickets up top and you've got to, you know, manage a chase now. And Livingston does it pretty well with Billings alongside him, which, you know, just shows England's depth. But I can't really say you learn much. I mean, you know, it was...
I'll tell you one thing you did learn is that the idea that Josh Butler categorically, because of his record, has to open the batting for England in T20s is an utter load of nonsense, isn't it? Because any of them could do it. Darren Millan gets a chance to do it. He makes runs. It isn't, you know, that whole argument based around, well, yeah, but look at how many, what his strike rate is and what he averages when he opens. The argument is never whether or not he's any good at opening. The argument is whether or not he's in the best place for England to win the tournament opening. And that's the question.
I kind of feel that.
And that hasn't been answered yet either, to my satisfaction.
I thought that train has passed, don't you think? That, like, we talked a lot about this last year when it seemed like England didn't know what they wanted to do. But it does just look like England have put all their money on Butler opening.
Yeah, I mean, that's I get your point, but I think England will just still, it's nailed on, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
they're
not. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that one question that was answered was that if Josh Butler doesn't open, is it going to be a disaster for England? No, it's not, because any one of the others could do it too.
All of them
that's,
open.
That's the point, I think.
I totally see that. I mean, he's obviously our best finisher. He's also probably, by a nose, the best batsman in the first six. So do you take a bob each way? Do you go on the old principle that your best players need to face as many deliveries as possible in 120 ball game cricket? you can spin it different ways. Personally, come the really, really big games, I like to see him go out there. I remember the 80-odd he got against Australia maybe 2 years ago or maybe last year.
Yeah.
Was it last year?
Yeah.
And England finished up sort of four or five down that day, and it was a last over finish, but he was in complete control from the start. And that was a good seam attack he faced. And he was 24 off 25 initially. And then once he was in, then he got going. But, you know, Mark's right. I mean, you know, you can bat him at five and you can trust he'll finish the game in the last six as well. So it's tricky. Just on Milan, who's, you know, another 70 ball, 45, 40 ball, 45 ball, 75. That was a Freudian right there. and then, you know, I had to
Mitali
answer...
Mitali Raj you were talking about.
Sorry, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and had to answer questions again about his strike rate from, you know, upstart journalists like yourself and Taha and all the rest of them. it just seems like everyone's always constantly getting at this fella. And he sometimes doesn't do himself any favours because he's a bit ham-fisted in how he answers certain questions. He's not a particularly clubbable kind of cricketer. He's had one or two run-ins off the pitch as well with the media and so on. He doesn't do himself any favours. And I can understand the discussion, but it's like you just set your watch by it. You set your watch by it. 24 hours before Milan gets a 45 ball 70, there will be a whole tranche of stuff online talking about how he's a waste of space and this isn't his right format. And he can play any other game except T20, the one that he just happens to be the number one ranked batsman in the world. And I know that's slightly skewed. I know it's skewed, but even so.
No, I've got...
It always makes me laugh.
I've got a lot of respect for the sort of inevitability of Dawid Milan, where you've got a couple of low scores.
A good name for a story, the inevitability of Dawid Milan.
You've got a couple of low scores, you know, the strike rate's not looking good. And then, so, you know, he just kind of pulls off that one innings where you're like, fair enough. And then you look at his overall record and you're like, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, I do think, though, the discussion about Milan before this game was, or this series, was different to the discussions about Milan previously. I think before it was very much, he's doing really well, but we have Joe Root out the side, and he does start quite slowly. Whereas this discussion was actually, he was just out of nick. He hadn't got many runs across quite a few different competitions. He barely got a run in the Blast. So he had actually gone
He had made two almost double centuries in the Championship for
Yorkshire. That's true. So that's true. In T20 cricket, though, he's...
Yeah, UKIS yeah. just loves to get the knives out, don't you? You can hear it in the press box.
He was talked about. Well, I think I even mentioned him as somebody that could very easily slot back into England's top three if the current mob continue to make such quite a hash of it. So
yeah, I don't know the circumstances around the reason why he had to leave the one day squad for personal reasons. But just on a cricketing level, you know, it's a blow for him because I think he would have probably played yesterday. I think he might have played on the game on Thursday when this show will probably be coming out. And a lot of people say 50 overs might be the most perfect for him in that he can start on his own terms and then expand as he tends to do. Definitely, he's an enigma in English cricket, Milan, but the story's not over. And he's got runs in Australia, as we know. We'll come down to that conversation again down the line, but I'd be very surprised if he's not in that 17 come the end of the summer.
I think one of the most interesting things from this series was something that happened off the field. It was after the series, Owen Morgan name-checking Tamar Mills as someone as being still on England's radar despite not having played for England for over 4 years now. I asked that five or so minutes ago, have England learned anything? And one thing they definitely didn't learn is who their death bowlers are. Partly because they weren't really needed to bowl the death in this series. Chris Jordan's had a tough time of it for England recently, as has Tom Curran. Those are two guys who have done a lot of death bowling. One of the things that's held Chris Wokes back in his T20 career has been death bowling. Joffa Archer, obviously brilliant at basically everything he does with a white ball, but if you had to pick one weakness, it would be death bowling. So there is still that gap in the setup. But do you think Mills will come in?
Well, it was, you're right. It did make me arch an eyebrow to hear Owen Morgan say something like that. And he doesn't waste his words, Owen, so that was calculated, I'm sure. And that means that he's thinking about it. And it means that in much the same way that Joffa Archer was able to come in at the last minute to a settled 50-over squad and knock out the likes of Willie before the 50-over World Cup, that could very easily happen before the T20 World Cup. And I like that about Morgan. He's not sentimental. He's looking at it. He's saying, we've got a tournament to win. The only thing that matters is the trophy. And if I think we need a 90-mile-an-hour... slower ball slinging left arm beast, then I'm going to have him. And you know, so I think it's a very clever thing to do, to let Mills know that he's being thought of and looked at, encourage him to try and stay fit if he can, and to keep the performances up. And there's every chance he'll be on the plane. Because, you know, Tom Curran, Sam Curran, Chris Jordan, you know, CJ's kind of like a must pick, or he's the first name on the team sheet, it would appear. But you can't help but thinking, crikey, his numbers have not been great for quite some time. And the one thing about Chris Jordan is this, is that he will win you probably, what, 1 out of 5 at the end? You know what I mean? He does that, the impossible, where he's defends 7 or something and suddenly you've won the game, or he'll come in and do something like that. But then the rest of the time, he's kind of, anonymous isn't the right word, but it's kind of, oh, anybody could have done that. So, you know, he is not as reliable, or as he's not infallible enough to be the one specialist death bowler that England have. Tom Curran has had his problems too, and they're very similar in terms of pace and approach at the end. So it'd probably be rather useful, particularly given Jofra's predicament with injury and stuff at the moment, to have a proper, genuinely quick, unpleasant angle, excellent slow ball bowling specialist in Mills waiting in the wings.
Can I ask you a totally incongruous question? When you were playing, were you ever intimidated to the extent that it got inside your head? Because with Mills, you're talking extreme pace. Was there ever a time?
I can only remember once, and it was very brief. It was facing Morne Morkel for the first time, right, in a T20 game at Beckenham in the dark. And we needed 11s or something, and everything was at my neck. And I'm kind of thinking, well, I'm not seeing this particularly good. It's very, very fast, and I'm going to have to hook it, and it's probably going to tear my head off. And I was thinking, this is not fun. So that was about the only time. But as much because of the fact that you have, you know, if it had been a test match or something where you could bob and weave and wait for him to tire himself out, no problem. But you had to score at 12. Yeah. So that made it very unpleasant indeed.
Yeah. Morne Morkel running in at you in the dark. I think that answers every question.
That would have been, what, 2006, 2007, something like that. So he was young and very fast.
Yes, that sound fun. So how concerned do you think England should be about Owen Morgan's form? Is it one of those talking points you only really have where there aren't that many talking points? I mean, he hasn't passed 30 in 14 games.
Yeah, but I think... kind of looking at the stats yesterday, I mean, part of that is to do with him. He had this exceptional run basically after the 2019 World Cup in T20 internationals where, you know, he was striking at close to 190, averaging more than 50. And that was at 4. And basically with, I know, Bairstow taking that 4 position and England kind of needing to solve that finisher role, he's dropped down. And yeah, he's definitely struggling. But I mean, that's going to happen when you're in that role. I mean, are you asking, is there pressure on his place?
No. Yeah. More in terms of like, he's obviously going to play. That's not the question. But just like,
he's going to end up at 5 or 6, isn't he?
Yeah.
When England are back at full strength, that's where he'll end up. And he will take on the responsibility himself as being the finisher.
But it's,
I mean, I'm not. I completely ignore what Owen Morgan does most of the time. Until you get to series, yeah, and things that matter.
Exactly.
He's been doing it for so long, it's just kind of like, just don't worry about it. He's in that team at the moment to suss out where all the rest of the pieces fit around him, and then he'll concentrate on himself when he gets to that point, I should think.
And he's a guy who's gone through some serious lean patches before.
Exactly,
I mean,
yeah.
I remember, you know, before that 2015 World Cup, where he was really struggling, and he obviously struggled through that World Cup, but then... You know, when he kick-started the whole new, you know, white ball revolution, whatever, he was the guy who did it. You know, he was brilliant that series against New Zealand, basically that summer. So he has this way of finding it when he needs to. You know, and so
it's too old to waste energy.
Yeah,
and that's what it is. Yeah. He's conserving until it's important.
And you never look at Owen Morgan and kind of feel worried about him because he's like. Icy cool. It's like, oh, it'll be all right. It'll be fine.
Yeah. That's reassuring. Tara, what's your moment of the week?
I was watching Chris Wokes yesterday when he was, you know, kind of unplayable maiden, wicket maidens, whatever. And he was creeping up on a potential fifer. And then I'm just like, I'll have a look at his numbers. And yesterday he went past 150 ODI wickets. And then I was like, he's got two sixfers in ODI cricket. You know, he could get another one today. And then you think, and then you look, and the only people with more ODI wickets for England are Anderson, Gough, Broad, Flintoff and Rashid. He's got a better average than Broad and Rashid. He's got more fifers than all of them. And then suddenly I'm kind of thinking, oh God, he's Chris Wokes, England's greatest ever ODI bowler. And it's just a thought that crept on me, because it's like Chris Wokes, I mean, it's always cliche to say he's just like this super nice guy, but it's also kind of true. And then you don't associate that with greatness in a way. We know Chris Wokes is an exceptional bowler, but we kind of forget it sometimes as well. And then I thought, you know, three for in that World Cup semi-final.
You don't play for a year.
Three for, had to be rested off his three overs as well.
Three for in the semi-final of that 2019 World Cup. Three for in the final that everyone kind of forgets as well, I guess. And then the argument mounts. And then you look at his stats with the bat as well. And he's just been such a good cricketer. And then, you know, part of me also, we've talked about this for quite a few years, where it's like, you know, if there wasn't Broad or Anderson, Wokes would have played this many tests, taking this many wickets. And you actually see that in the ODI format, where after that World Cup 2015, Anderson, Broad dropped out, Wokes became the attack leader, and he's been phenomenal ever since. And so you wonder what would have happened if the same thing would have happened in Test cricket.
We're going to find out in Australia.
Yeah, but we've seen it. We've seen it in ODIs, and it's, yeah. It just crept on me, that thought yesterday, and I think it's a strong argument to make, actually.
Yeah, 100%. With that new ball, he's just so good. He kind of bowls like almost like a test match opening bowler.
Yeah,
like,
pretty much.
Genuine
yeah.
wicket taker, not going for much run, hits a hard length.
I think he's one of the greatest sportsmen in Britain.
Is this because you played him in snooker?
But football he was on Villa's books as well. Brilliant golfer. Snooker, might have mentioned that before.
Batted three in World Cup.
But his skill level across the board, across the three formats as well, is outstanding. Especially as the white ball doesn't swing for more than 5 minutes. He said this to me. He said, if you can get two overs of actual swing with the white ball, then it's a result. But after that, straight away, you're cutting it. It's out the back of the hand. You're holding it. You're using the crease, etc., etc., etc. His skill levels are superb. His action is immaculate. He's very, very rarely injured because everything goes through straight. Technically very sound with the bat, all the rest of it. I mean, there was even people kind of getting wild about him batting at three for England. Do you remember that in Test cricket when there was no one who could do it? And then looking around and says, he plays straight, he'll do it. But it does sort of tap into this kind of, this Wokesian thing about him being kind of an immaculate cricketer. But sometimes that you end up taking that for granted because everything looks just so. And there's no kind of danger there. But the numbers are beginning to creep up. Is he one of England's greats? No. Is he one of the key people that got that World Cup over the line? Absolutely. You know, that semi-final belonged to Wokes. That opening spell against India in the group stage is in a must-win, belonged to Wokes. He will go to Australia this winter. And he may well struggle on those kinds of merciless pitches because he's not got that absolute pace and he doesn't have that particular height. But that's not to say that he doesn't have an immense legacy that he's left on English cricket over the last 10 years.
Another player that we maybe take for granted a bit, Joe Root, is creeping up on a very special record.
Yeah, 70-odd shy of becoming England's all-time cross-format batsman. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's what, 32?
No, just 30.
30.
Yeah, he's just 30.
Blimey. Yeah, I mean, where do you start? Firstly, he expected to have had a lot more. He's riled that he doesn't play T20 cricket and mentions it every single week whenever he's asked. He plays every game available for Yorkshire in T20 cricket as well, just to keep making this point. So for his money, he should have a lot more. He should also, whisper it, have more in Test cricket as well. And yeah, we've spoken about this before, and how long do we keep going before it has to become a proper significant conversation about his form at home, in particular against seam. all of that said, he's the most graceful player that I've seen play for England of this era. And he's combined that kind of cussedness, that technical excellence, with style and grace as well. And the impudence of the early years as well. I mean, you'd want to watch him. You know, with Cookie, bless him, if you missed the first half hour of the morning, it didn't matter too much. Whereas with Root, in that golden period, that middle part of the last decade, that 2015 era when he was just untouchable as a test match batsman and as a one day batsman, as a 50 over player, he's an astonishing player because you can just hang everything around him. In that middle period, he was just a dream, a celestial player. And is there going to be a third, fourth act in Joe's batting career?
Yes.
Now, you believe that and you hope that, and by no means am I questioning that, but it's due, isn't it? It's now. It's two huge series coming up, and he's played 10 test matches in Australia, and he's not made 100, and he's struggled. Well, he's not struggled. He was actually great
Some
last
time
out.
Two.
Is that right? just peel one off at Brisbane today. So, you know, loads of cliches around it about how it's a pivotal time for him, but it really is for him because he won't get too many more tours out to Australia. And that is so much of how you measure yourself. I was out there last time. We all saw what it was like for him. You know, he was on a drip come the end of it in Sydney. And he will go back more determined than ever before to finally make his mark. In England, he's got an excellent Ashes record. In Australia, he's got a poor one. It really is now for him to really nail down all of those hopes and dreams that we've always put on him. He's already 80-odd runs away from being untouchable. But the question is, can he be one of the all-time greats, one of the all-timers? And that's what's up for grabs for him.
Absolutely. Butch, you're in Bristol for the first women's ODI this week. England won that very, very comfortably. Runs for Beaumont, Skiver, a very straightforward run chase. Beaumont's record recently is amazing. I think she's got a 15 every time she's batted in ODI cricket this year, number one in the world.
Yeah, I think she's just had four. She's got four on the bounce at the moment.
Yeah,
joining the likes of, I think, Jan Britton, etc., etc. on that. Only Charlotte Edwards has done it five on the trot. And six on the trot, I think, in consecutive runs. So, yeah, I mean, she's a very, very good player. Mm. Very, very good. And has a game for pretty much everything. Nat Siver, obviously, terrific cricketer. And, you know, she could become one of the best to do it. You know, she's been hot on the heels of somebody like Elise Perry. Perhaps hasn't quite got the skill with the ball, but with the bat, she could. The disappointing thing for me about the whole thing was that England sort of were very, very good indeed, extremely competent in all areas and excellent in some others. But that India, going into the series, the sort of all the chat had been around, you know, their scoring rates, their kind of, you know, their ability to post scores, the fact that their sort of average score is around about the 210 mark in 50-over cricket. And that the basic reason for that is that they've got some terrific ball strikers, some terrific players in Smriti Mandanna and Shefali Verma, obviously the new youngster on the block, Deepti Sharma, Jemima Rodrigues, who doesn't even get into the side at the moment. And in the middle of that, they've got the highest scoring run scorer in women's one-day international cricket in Mithali Raj, most caps, who in the last 10, 11 games has averaged 50. 430 runs, averaging 50, but a strike rate of 63.
Mm.
Right, and this is before a ball had been bowled in the game. England win the toss, stick India in. India 2 for 20 in fourth or fifth over or something. So not a terrific start, but not a crisis. And the captain walks to the crease and plays lots and lots of beautiful drives to extra cover for no run, mid off and mid on for no run. Has no hustle, no sort of thought about trying to put a little bit of pressure back on England through the entire innings. She bats all the way through until there are about four overs left, makes 70 and a strike rate of 60. And they get 201 for 8 and lose the game and 15 overs to spare.
And as you call on commentary as well, quite early on, it was an absolute road. It was a really good pitch. It was a really good pitch.
Is this an attitude thing, or is it that she no longer change gears?
I interviewed her at the end, and she put the defeat down to the bowlers not bowling the right sort of line and length, to which my eyebrows arched once more, and then to the fact that none of the other batters could stay with her and, you know, were good enough to do anything, to which my eyebrows jumped up to the back of my head. I said, what, do you not think that the strike rate might be something of an issue posting totals? Oh, no, well, maybe we'll look at that. Maybe we'll look at some of the other players and who we can bring in. I was thinking, I'm talking about you. But she doesn't see it.
One thing,
she does not see it, that perhaps her approach or what she is doing is kind of putting a handbrake on the younger and sort of more vivacious stroke players around her. And I honestly think, and this is probably sacrilegious to those Indian fans who revere her, that they will be a better side when she's no longer in it. That's my view.
One thing that was quite interesting was they didn't lose those two early wickets at the same time. So they were 24 for one, I think, in the fifth over. Then Rout came at three. She was like one off 20 when Mandana gets out. And suddenly they've gone from 24 for nothing in the fifth over to 28 for two after 10 overs. Yeah. I kind of wonder if like that kind of that negativity is contagious almost, when you get one person coming out blocking it. So it takes all the sting out of that actually quite good start.
Absolutely. And, you know, so Kate Cross and so the England's change bowlers. I think Catherine Brunt decided that she was going to run up and put two fielders back on the leg side and was going to bowl short to Verma, which worked. Shrubsole bowled as she does. She ended up knocking over Mandana with one that didn't swing massively away from her, and she gave herself a bit of room. But then Kate Cross came in and bowled us like a seven over spell for nothing. She ran up and bowled line and length to keep her up, and they literally just kept patting her straight back down the pitch without trying to do anything. So yeah, I mean, you're right. But I think if from the top, if you're sort of, you know, your most senior player, the person that if you were expecting somebody to come out and kind of dominate proceedings and have a bit of presence and kind of go, right, well, I'm the boss out here. I've done this 1,000 times. Watch me. If the boss comes out and does and plays it like that, then why should anybody else do any different? We'll all try and average 50 with a strike rate of 60. Thanks very much. We might not win very many games, but some of us will make a lot of runs. You know, I hope that the game's on today, isn't it? It's Wednesday now, and when this will go out. So we'll see if any of that criticism has kind of snuck through with India in the match today. I hope it has.
Yeah.
But the most annoying thing about it is we're not talking about a team that can't take care of itself, that doesn't have players who are not capable of going out and playing like Tammy Beaumont and Nat Siver and giving it a good bang and really kind of giving a positive account for themselves. That's why, you know, somebody like Shefali Verma has become, you know, somebody that everybody's excited to see. They've got three or four players who are capable of playing like that, but none of them want to.
And England will back themselves kind of like however well you bowl to get a total of 300 on a good pitch as well. Like that method of playing, you're just not going to get your results against teams like this. Their results are bad as well.
Very deep.
Yeah.
And they will try, you know, England are kind of taking it on board because they think the team we have to beat if we're going to win World Cups is going to be Australia. Australia are going to make 250 scores plus. More often than not. And so if we're going to hang with them, if we're going to have to turn them over in a semi-final or a final, we're going to have to be able to do that ourselves. And so that's why they're doing it. I mean, India at the moment are sort of hoping that they might squeak out of a group stage playing the way that they're playing. They're not going to win it playing like that.
Yeah, and so close to winning it in 2017, lost this game, lost at home to South Africa recently as well.
And the World Cup's just sneaking up on us. It's, you know, we're already January, February, 2022 in New Zealand, you know, pitches in New Zealand are going to be good for stroke play. So come on, come on.
Before we continue the rest of the show, a plug for the Wisden Summer Party Pack. You can save £100 with our special bundle offer, where you get 10 cans of our afternoon session pale ale and 10 cans of our little Wonder Amber Ale. You get 6 Wisden tankards and a complete set of 48 Wisden Cricket of the Year beer mats, each with a little profile on each of them. It's kind of like perfect barbecue kit, isn't it? Everyone gets their own tankard, enough beer for everyone. You save £100 with that. So check out wisden.com/shop to get one of those. The blast has been roaring on. Glamorgan beat Surrey by one run last night. You might have missed it. They withstood a...
Why might we have missed it?
some football thing happening somewhere. Withstanding a late burst of fireworks from Carl Jameson, who hit a 15-ball 31 in vain. Stevie Eskenazi is in great form at the moment. Middlesex, he's hit scores of 102 not out, 64 and 91 not out in his last three games.
Yeah, I saw that game against Essex when he got 100, got a brilliant 100. I was watching it on the stream. Yes. And Essex somehow managed to win it with a four off the last over in the end. But having cruised it, then lost it, then cruised it, then lost it and all of that. But to see the Middlesex boys at the end of it, and they won actually the game after, but they were absolutely crushed. And there's sometimes that sense that the circus rolls on and another day, another game, and you forget about it, you know, and so on. No. Those boys were really, really, really crushed by that. And you know, when you're on a losing streak, it's hellish, you know. And you said it can be contagious, how it affects everybody. You know, this is what you saw with Middlesex last week. So fair play to them for getting over the line the game after. And Eskenazi, he's a good player.
Yeah, it's a hard competition to kind of bounce back from a couple of like.
It's just relentless
because there's a game every other day.
Yeah, Surrey had six home games in 12 days. That's just home games.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Some guy called Ben Stokes, he took a fourth for Durham against Birmingham. There's a century for Alex Hales as Notts' good form continued. They're second in the North group at the moment. Tom Banton is back in the run. He scored a rapid 77 and then hit an unbeaten 47-ball 100 a couple of days ago. Butch, that was your moment of the week.
Well, I mean, that game was moment of the week. It was one of those afternoons that I will remember for a long time. Not because of Tom Banton's extraordinary assault on the poor Kent bowlers. Darren Stevens, that's how you play Darren Stevens, everyone. get him over mid-wicket for six, get him out of there. But for playing in conditions that I've never seen before. I've seen it in short periods of time at Hove when the fret rolls in off the beach.
Them.
Well, it was just like playing in a pea super. I was expecting the phantom raspberry blower of old London town to pop out of an alleyway. You know, it was just extraordinary, sort of thick, wet, heavy air that, you know, that you could barely see through for most of Kent's batting innings. But Banton was stunning. Lewis Gregory bowled very, very smartly, protecting a short boundary to pick up four for. And Somerset looked really, really good. I mean, they've kind of just got themselves up into the reckoning now in terms of qualification. It's going to be very, very tight, I think, in the South group to the finish. But my moment of the week, Banton, yeah, brilliant, great to watch, was Nick Knight attempting to do a demo in the moments between the two innings in the changeover to try and illustrate just how difficult it was to see out in the ground. So he'd managed to get hold of a bat. I think Lydia Greenway had a bat in the boot of her car, and the cars were all parked up behind where we were in the pod. So that was all there. So you got all the cameras and the lights out and everything like this. And Knighty is trying to, I don't know what, he must have had a clip-on microphone or something. But three times he tried to hit a catch, you know, like a little skyer, one-handed to Simon Dawe, right? Dawley of no legs, no knees. He's had knee replacements, can't move. So Knighty goes, plink, hits this thing. It must have gone up about 15 feet in the air and dropped over the boundary, right? So that's take one. So everyone's kind of like, oh, God, what are we doing here? So he tries it again. This one goes 20 feet in the air and again plops over the boundary, nowhere near where Simon Dawe is. And so he has another go. He's just thinking, now is the time to quit, Knighty. He has another go, hits it off the inside edge this time. It goes in the other direction, 30 yards away from Simon Dawe, who just kind of stands around and goes, mate, give it away. And that was our halftime wrap done. Yeah. So we were back out on the field to watch Banton smash it.
That's all on video?
I think, yeah, we should have that. I mean, it was so bad that it might not even make the bloopers.
Okay, really? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that was my moment of the week.
You need to put some pressure on the relevant people.
Get that out there.
Elsewhere, Yorkshire at the top of the North group. They scored 226 against Northants. Half century for Mark Stoneman, who's on loan there from Surrey. And Jordan Thompson scored a 35-ball 74. I think we'll probably talk about him later in the show, but he's enjoying an incredible season, particularly in the white ball stuff. Ben's not here to explain this one, so I'll have to explain it for him. We had one of those games where the DLS kind of loophole was in play. the other day in the game between Sussex and Surrey. So basically, Sussex's run chase was interrupted after 4.5 overs. You need 5 overs for a result. But Sussex were well ahead of both the DLS par score and what the adjusted 5 over target would have been had there been a revised target set. So they were 43 for 1 in pursuit of 176. Had the umpires decided that a game could, a 5 over game could be finished, there'd been a readjusted target of 39, which is obviously less than 43. And Sussex wouldn't have required to face another ball, but there was no play possible, so the match was abandoned. They had already overtaken the five over mark that was required
to win the game.
Yeah.
But that final delivery could not be bowled because it was raining.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, but it was in the beautiful middle point where if the umpires had said earlier, we got enough for a 5-0 game, their target would have just been 39, so they would have already won.
Sure, sure. Oh, my word.
And apparently it had rained pretty much throughout the game.
Yeah.
Listen, Sussex were robbed. There's no two ways about it by the sounds of things. Surrey were lucky to squeak away with it a point. But I do have an issue with the ruling whereby once one team has managed to get through 20 overs, that all the chasing team has to do is to beat the target over 5. I mean, if you think about what constitutes a game in a 50-over contest, you have to get 20 overs in, right? 20 overs being, what, 2/5 of the innings.
Whereas this is a
quarter. It's not enough for me. I think it should be adjusted that if only in the case where the team batting first has batted the entire 20 overs, that you should need to bat half. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think that's a valid point for it to constitute
a game. So up until that point, it doesn't matter. But once you've got 10, then all of a sudden the DLS kicks in.
I don't think
it's very fair. Which is not to say that Surrey shouldn't have got away with not losing the game the other night, given the rules as they were. I don't think that the rules as they are very good.
Yeah, no, I think that's completely valid. I mean, on the DLS thing, it's worth clarifying, like, it is a loophole, but it does happen. Last season, this happened in a Kent Blast game. It also happened with Australia in the Champions Trophy in a game that basically cost them their spot in the tournament. And Messrs Duckworth and Lewis themselves have said that the ICC are not implementing their own thing properly. Right. So change it.
So you can imagine what was going on in the dressing room. And you can imagine the Surrey lads as well. Yeah. Just sort of quickly just get
back
all this stuff.
Kit.
Yeah, leg it. Leg it back to London. Nothing to do with us. Yeah.
Pretty quick. Don't you worry
nothing
about
to
that.
Do with us.
Yeah, Luke Wright posted a GIF on Twitter that suggested that he wasn't happy. I spoke to someone at Kent when exactly the same thing happened to them last season. And they said not only were they not happy, but they were actually speaking to the ECB to try and get them to change it as well.
Right.
Like, I'm sure, obviously, Surrey don't mind it after this game, but surely every county would rather that
and, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a contingency for what happened. We all know what happens or the adjustment that's made if the first innings doesn't get completed. You know, you then make the adjustment, and everybody knows where they stand. Everyone knows where they stand. Hopefully, by the time you've resumed the next innings, you know how many you've got to get, and you know what the amount of overs is. But in the event that you imagine having got through 20 overs that it's going to be a 20 over run chase, you can't then to start and then realise 3.5 overs in that, oh my goodness, we're not going to get them all in. We just need to get 5 in. That's, I mean, the fielding side generally has no price, do they? No price at all.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I totally go with this. It does need to be stretched further for there to be more ebbs and flows in the context of that innings. Because otherwise, you know, you got ten geezers in the hutch, or nine waiting to get in, and
8 and over.
And even if you got 10 and over, then it's a doddle. Yeah. 12 and over, it should be a doddle.
And you've got, no one has any way of knowing just at which point the 5 over thing is going to kick in. Do you? You don't know.
Yeah,
which is why I wonder. And again, this, I'm not saying that this is right, and I'm not making any excuses for what happened down at Hove. I'm really not. But I wonder whether the umpires kind of looked at it and went, you know what? I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure we can give one side or the other 2 points in this then, under these circumstances. Let's cull it before it happens.
Yeah, possibly. How else to explain being one ball shy of a result?
Yeah.
But then you can understand it's
not their place to do that as well. I have to say that, you know, isn't their place to kind of make a moral judgment?
No, absolutely not. but even if there were only a few hundred people in that ground, there'd have been, you know, pissed right through, been rained on for two or three hours. There'll be some young folk in there as well who are thinking, oh, what's this? What's all this about? And then you go home and you say, who won? Well, it was a draw. What do you mean it was a draw? Well, they needed to bowl one more ball and then Team A would have won. But as it was a draw. So they bowled 150-odd deliveries, but they couldn't bowl 151. And people are and we're trying to sell the game. We're trying to convince people this is the greatest game ever made.
Yeah. Sometimes we definitely don't help ourselves.
No, we do not.
One thing that I've not heard, I don't think I've heard anyone make this point, but looking at that, their 5-over target was only 39, which is 8-and-over-ish, chasing a total where you needed basically 9-and-over to win. Mm. I wonder if DLS like properly takes into consideration power play is when you're supposed to be hitting, you know, that's the easiest time to bat.
No, I don't know, but that's entirely my point, isn't it? You know, Surrey's innings was adjusted based on the amount of wickets they lost batting first over a 20-over period.
Yeah.
Whereas the adjustment is made for a team who have all 10 wickets in the hutch to bat for 5 overs. I mean, that's just nonsense.
Yeah.
That's complete nonsense.
Mm. No, completely agree. So there's the 100 wildcard draft on Friday. Each side still has one player to pick. Do you want to pick out a few players that we should keep our eyes on or you think might get picked up?
Yeah, I mean, one would be one you mentioned a bit earlier in this podcast, who's Jordan Thompson, Yorkshire, pace bowling all-rounder. But he's really been giving it whack with the bat. I think 66 off 28 against Worcester at 7 a week ago. And then he batted at 3 a few days ago and hit, you know, another half century, whatever. 71 or something like that. So he's one to look out for. Doesn't have a 100 contract. So there, Eskenazi is timing. The thing is, you want to be timing your run well. And Eskenazi is. He's had a seriously staggeringly good week.
And it's not a long tournament. The tournament doesn't start in a very long time either.
So you want to be informed,
You know, there's brains behind picking someone who's just in incredible nick at the moment.
So another one would be Sam Hain, who started off the tournament really well, but then if you look at his last couple of innings, he's just got a duck and a two. I mean, he will still be in the mix, but it's like you want to come to Friday just having had a week like Eskenazi, where you've, you know, reeled off a ton at Lords and had, you know, hit a couple of match-winning half centuries, basically.
Another Yorkshireman I'd pick out is Bess. Bess has had a really good blast and he's not played a lot of white ball cricket. And he wasn't picked up, he's not got an England contract. So I think he'll be one of them. Butch, anyone to pick out?
Left arm spin, Moriarty. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm quite surprised he hasn't been picked up at all, actually. So I suspect he might, they will have a look at him. Whoever the coaches are.
Conway and de Kock signed up, though, for Southern Brave.
Yes.
Did we discuss that last week?
No, we didn't.
No. So this is quite significant, I think, because this runs or fails, I think, on the quality of the fair, but also the quality of the overseas as well. And to have those two, de Kock and Conway might not be a household name yet, but he's a serious talent, as we know, and de Kock is one of the greats of the modern game. So to have those two signed up now is replacing Stoinis and one other Australian. Who is it? Warner. Yeah, okay. Who are not coming over for COVID reasons. To have quality there, real quality, you know, we're not kind of grabbing them from Division 2 or 3 here, you know. So that's a feather in the cap for the tournament.
Arguably in 2021, they're, you know, as good as picks as those two guys were in 2019. Just on the wild card, one player I've talked about before in the pod who I think will get picked up, Jake Linter at Warwickshire or Birmingham. Yeah. Left arm wrist spinner, one of few in the country. His economy rate in particular has been excellent in his season and a half. For Warwick and the Blast, so I think he'll get picked up as well. But that's on Friday and should be quite interesting. And elsewhere in the county game, there's a massive round of the Championship starting this weekend. By my maths, with one or two games to go, 13 out of the 18 counties still are in with a shot of qualifying for Division 1, which is very exciting.
We've discussed it before. I like, broadly supportive, I think, of the format. Looking at it now, after that first round has revolved, a slight recalibration of the numbers, I reckon. You know, Essex have played 9 games, I think, now. I think one or two others have played 9 as well, which means they've only got one game left. For me, probably 7-3 or even a 6-4 would maybe be a better reflection. And it would also help the England Test side as well, because you'd have players who are playing 4-day cricket in the build-up to the marquee series. As it stands, if you just take Lawrence as one who might get the gig, he's going to have two red ball innings in like the 7 weeks from his final test match to, in theory, the first test against.
But you're making lots of noises.
Yeah, yeah. Well, only because I could not agree more. I mean, the idea that there are only, for most teams, there are only two matches of four-day cricket or significant four-day cricket left. You know, there are, you know, there will be games played afterwards and Division 1 will be contested, et cetera, and then there'll be sort of, I don't know, benefit games is not quite right, but sort of, not promotional,
games
trially type game. Yeah. You know, well, a little bit like, no, I mean, you know, you can giggle about it, but they're a little bit like the matches that used to be when you got to the, last four or five rounds of the season when you had a one division county championship, or maybe, you know, with five or six rounds left, where teams would then, as a matter of course, would play younger up and coming players who perhaps wouldn't get a gig in their strongest 11, or you might, you know, retire off a couple of players early and get some of the young thrusters in. That used to happen as a matter of course in a one division championship and became more and more scarce as promotion and relegation sort of put the brakes on any of that type of experimentation. So that's the word I was looking for, experimental rounds in the other two divisions. And so, you know, there is some merit there, and you might, you know, a few stars of the future might appear where they might otherwise not have had a gig in the old way of doing things.
And you saw that last year.
I completely agree with Phil. I mean, 7-3, 6-4. I mean, for two reasons. One, obviously, that there's going to be more meaningful four-day cricket, and whilst the England are getting ready to pick their test teams, yes, more chances for batters to get a chance of batting in better, slightly better or different conditions as the summer wears on. And also because the bowlers were absolutely hanging. They played, some of them played 9 matches in the space of less than 2 months at the beginning of the season, which is, none of which is good for the overall standard of the cricket. So, yeah, find a way of doing it, please.
And last season, actually, you did see the benefit of games with the benefits of having games with not that much on them. Is you saw a lot of young players make their debuts who've gone on to have really good seasons this year. Cool. Elsewhere in the international game, the ICC have announced, as expected, that the T20 World Cup will be held in the UAE and Oman and in the Caribbean at the moment. We'll talk about this a little bit more next week when the series is finished, but South Africa currently 2-1 up against West Indies in West Indies in the Caribbean. Third game is a bit of a thriller. South Africa won that by 1 run. To finish off the show, we've got a few questions from the listeners. Taha, Butch and Phil haven't actually seen them.
This is your Fiona Bruce impression, isn't it? I like it.
Question for you, Phil.
Right.
From the Run Out blog.
Yeah.
Directed to you, because I know you've talked about this before. This is a passion of yours.
Maybe you should direct it elsewhere then.
The decline of the big-bottomed fast bowler has been fairly sharp. Is this the end, or is it more cyclical and they'll come back sooner rather than later? Jofra is the only one I can really think of.
Jofra doesn't have a big bum.
I was thinking that as well.
Jofra doesn't have. I don't want to debate that too long. It's a marvellous question. I just have images of Matthew Hoggard running in at Sydney. Yeah, my word. There's always room for a nice big arse in cricket. Let's put it that way.
Excellent.
Next.
Well answered. Butch, Richard asks. So when overrated are talked about a lot, I think I'm definitely guilty. I'm not sure this is a bad thing to be guilty of not really paying much attention to that debate, because I think it can be quite tiresome and I don't really care that much. But people do care, and Richard is one of those people who does care.
Fiona Bruce would never do it like this.
He asked, why do umpires not enforce overrates in professional cricket? We do it in a recreational game. Why are fans regularly shortchanged by seeing fewer overs than they paid for? When and how will this change?
That's a good question.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point.
The umpires have limited powers to do anything about it. They can chivvy the captains along, and there can be fines, which I think are useless in all forms of cricket, actually, because the only way to get people to do what you want them to do is to penalise them in the match that they're playing in, not financially some point down the line when they probably won't even notice it's come out of their bank account. I would argue slightly that if you buy a ticket for a 50 over match or a 20 over match, you're expecting the amount of overs in a 4 day or a test match game, you're not paying for overs, you're paying for the day at the game, day's cricket. You know, as evidenced by the fact that you could buy a ticket for the last day of the game, which might be discounted, and it could be over before, after lunchtime. You've got a result, but you're not getting the overs. So the frustration I can totally understand. One of the things that I think is mitigating in all of this that gets so easily overlooked by commentators and by fans alike is this. That even though over rates have been slow historically, the West Indies, of course, were famous for getting down to 11 overs an hour. And Clive Lloyd's answer to that was always, well, we've just beaten you in 2.5 days, you know. We're actually early. Don't worry about is this. And on a normal test match day, whereby if there were 10 wickets taken, right, every wicket you're supposed to get 2 minutes added on. So let's say, for example, you've got the day is 6 hours, three 2 hour sessions, and you take 10 wickets, you've got another 20 minutes of play has been removed, right? So that takes you up to 6 hours 20. Then if you get a change of innings, that's another 10 minutes, which takes you up to 6.5 hours. So there you go. That's why 6:30 is the kind of like the cutoff point. It gives you the chance to take all the wickets and have a change of innings. Add to that, every single time there's a DRS review, drinks breaks that happen on the hour, every hour of every session, various whatever the other stoppages might be. And people will say, oh, you know, players running drinks on and off. That very rarely ever causes any time to be lost. And, you know, the 12 men are on and off with a flash before the ball gets bowled. Captains perhaps taking a little bit of time to set a field or whatever. The DRS reviews alone knock out 15 minutes a day of your play.
At least.
And so yeah. 15 minutes when you're not playing counts for what? We're talking four overs just gone, just like that. And there's no way of putting that time back into the game. So even when we were in Sri Lanka, which I believe I may have mentioned already in the pod, and spin was being bowled nearly for the whole time because of those things, because of things like DRS, which didn't exist before. Even bowling spin nearly all day, we didn't finish at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock on the dot. You were always needed to go into the extra half an hour to get your overs in. So there are lots of things at play here. You could say, of course, well, why don't you just elongate the day? Why don't you just go, okay, yeah, we're going to start at 10:30, and the official close of play time is going to be 6:30, and then if we need to go on till 7, we go on till 7. Yeah, okay, you could do that.
If you've got the light.
You could do that.
Yeah.
You could do that. The one thing I would say is that the cricket teams, I mean, what it would do would force cricket teams not to go in with only four bowlers and things like that. You could find yourselves with some very, very long sessions out there in the field, which would hurt you in terms of trying to keep control of a game. And maybe that's not a bad thing either. I don't know. But that's the only way to do it. The only way to do it, I think, in the modern era, particularly for test match cricket, is to add another hour of actual playing time. Players aren't going to be happy with that. You add on 20 minutes per session, maybe. And there you go, and you've done it. And then they will still find a way of being slower than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a very fair point that 15 overs an hour in the modern game, with all the gizmos, all the stoppages, is a tough ask. I think that's a fair point.
But I think go on.
But starting the game at this kind of demure time of 11 o'clock, because it might do a bit too much and we need to get in our seats, you know, after having a nice breakfast and a coffee and so on. That to me is ludicrous. Yeah. The Ashes 05 started at 10:30 and that went okay from what I remember. The players might kick up a stink, but if we are committed to 90 overs a day, and if that is the figure that we think for a 450 over test match.
The players don't mind. I mean, you know, as a player, I quite like starting at 10:30. You get to the ground that little bit early, you get 10:30, you'd leave earlier. You'd have more night time. Woohoo! That was no
more
issue
hangover
with that.
Time.
No issue with that at all. You know, you start in India.
Yes, that's 9:30 in the morning. Yeah.
You know, so you're back at the hotel by 4:30.
I mean, I've never really understood the 11 o'clock start. I mean, why is that?
I mean, historically, it's the classy time to start. Dear old boy, I wouldn't be starting before 11.
Six hours of official playing time is not enough to get 90 overs a day. So you either make it so that it's an 80 over day, which I don't think would be satisfactory, or you add another 30 minutes of playing time plus the extra half an hour to get the rest of the overs in, which might concentrate a few minds in terms of getting through the overs a bit more. But I still think that you're really struggling because of the time that gets knocked out of a day's play by means that are not the player's fault.
Yeah.
That's an issue that the game hasn't had to encounter before, but no extra time has been found in order to offset it.
No, 100%. Final thing I'll say on this is... the final thing I'll say on this is that I think players are held to a completely unrealistic standard. Like, if you look at the ICC's own regulations, it says 15 overs an hour, but it takes out 5 minutes, which is an over at least, for the drinks break. So that's already 14. And then wickets are accounted for, DRS accounted for. It's actually pretty rare that teams get done for slow over eights, and there has to be about 11 or 12 overs to get done for it.
You make a very good point. So a lot of people may not realise this either. So if you start off on the hour, you're supposed to get 15 overs in, right? If you take a wicket in that, you lose 2 minutes, okay? So you take two wickets, 4 minutes, that's one over gone. So you're down to 14, right? And that's all it takes. As soon as you lose time, that time is allowed for things like wickets, for things like drinks breaks. And so all of this time is actually being eroded from the playing time without the spectators knowing it's even happening. And so more often than not, you might get to the end of the day's play and finish at 6:30, so you've taken up the extra half an hour that's been allotted to get the rest of the overs in. You still might be short on the overs, but when the umpires make their calculations, you're still not behind on time. You're still up with the required over rate because of the allowances you get for DRS, wickets, change of innings. All of these things come off the time.
Yeah, and going back to the question is, how can you actually change it? Teams now get punished more, I think, than they did before. Yet points, penalties in competitions that really matter. So hopefully we've answered that one. Couple of questions to finish. Taha, Tom asks, what is cricket's equivalent of the one-sided England-Germany rivalry? Tom asked that question before the game yesterday.
Forgive me, Butch, but you know, England-Australia, 90s.
not wrong.
India-Pakistan in ICC tournaments.
Yes. Yeah.
I just shouldn't say this out loud, should I? apart from the Champions Trophy, the great Champions Trophy 2017 game where Pakistan absolutely thrashed India.
Well, you could just say World Cups.
Sorry?
You could just say World Cups.
Yeah, all right, let's go with World Cups.
Well answered. And finally, let's go to Phil for this. Siddharth asks, can you suggest some good cricket books, past and present, especially some county specials or obscure stuff the fans aren't familiar with?
It's a great question. County books, great county books. Well, firstly, there is Stephen Chalke's magnum opus called Summer's Crown, The History of the County Championship. Stephen Chalke is a giant of cricket writing. And he's quite small, actually. But he's absolutely marvellous cricket writer. He's got great heart, great soul, great feel for the game. And he's put together the definitive story. It's a big, like, coffee table book. So I'd recommend that about county cricket. Sometimes I Forgot to Laugh by Peter Roebuck, who always kind of sort of skewered the clubbability of county cricket. Was a man slightly out of pace with the rest of it. He wrote a couple of books on county cricket as well. Praying for Rain was another one, so you get the kind of theme. A Lot of Hard Yakka by Simon Hughes, not of this parish, but of a similar parish to us. It's a classic book of its time. Plenty around county cricket. There's some really good sort of club histories as well. Andrew Colomossi, who is the son, the father of Tom Colomossi, who writes for the Evening Standard. He did a really, really good social history of Yorkshire cricket going back through the decades. I'd recommend that. But yeah, plenty of county cricket wise. Just more generally, my all-time favourite cricket book is Golden Boy from Christian Ryan, the Australian writer. Golden Boy and the Bad Old Days of Australian Cricket. Have you read that, Mark?
No.
Oh, you'd like it. So it's set during that era, the furry-bellied medallion era of Lilly, Marsh, Chappell. And Kim Hughes is this sort of ethereal batsman who only wanted to entertain. That was his only reason for playing the game. And of course, when you got blonde curly locks and you're 3 years younger than Lilly and you grew up in Western Australia around the corner from Lilly, and Lilly is obviously the alpha's alpha, and then you have this sort of flighty stroke maker who just wanted to entertain, there was a lot of tension between those two. Now, famously, Kim Hughes ended up captaining Australia, the youngest Australian captain of all time at that point. I think he was 23. And he ran that tour, the 81 tour, when Lillie and Marsh were recalled to it just a year or two after World Series cricket that Kim Hughes had stepped away from, wasn't a part of it, to stay loyal to the baggy green. And it's the story of that era in Australian cricket, but it's the story of men. It's the story of dressing rooms. It's the story of fragile egos. And it's also the story, literally, of Dennis Lillie and Kim Hughes fighting in a street not dissimilar to this in West London and ending up staggering back to their hotel room in nothing but a pair of pants. The most perfect sort of metaphor for that time.
Oh, a great book, that sounds.
It really is. And the thing is, no one would talk. Kim Hughes wouldn't talk to him, Christian Ryan. So it's a biography of Kim Hughes talking to other people, but it's more a tale of the time, really.
I think you sold that pretty well.
Yeah. The good Murungu by Alan Butcher.
Yes,
is a good read.
The great Murungu.
Tale of Zimbabwe and cricket in the last century.
That is genuinely, a real cracker. So that's obviously his dad, a couple of years out there and so on. That made our short list, actually, when we got a few wisdom heads together.
Yeah.
And we picked out Christian Ryan's book as the winner in the end.
Yeah.
Can I throw in an obscure one? Ed Cowan did a book about 10, 11 years ago. It was basically a season of life in the Sheffield Shield. That's quite obscure, but quite a nice read as well.
Oh,
before he played for Australia as well.
Oh, that is interesting. And Phil, there's going to be a book about Essex, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Let's reserve judgment on that one until I've written a few words of it.
Yeah. We've got that to look forward to. Anyway, yeah, right. Sorry we didn't get around to answering everyone's questions, but thanks for those. Cheers, Butch. Cheers, Tom. Cheers, Phil. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends, leave us a fine review, and we'll see you next week. Cheers.